Okay. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you. I was just telling someone that I feel like it's really my obligation. I've come from New York to Chicago after we had such a gracious visit by the Chicago Bears these past 2 weeks in New York. So this is my payback. So if I'm particularly painful and boring, this is for the drudging that the Giants and Jets got these past 2 weeks. But anyway, the topic we're going to talk about is you never stop being a parent relating to your grown-up child. Now, let me tell you a little bit of how this evolved, because it's very interesting. I try to come up with topics. You know, I've been speaking for a while, and there have been a lot of parenting workshops, etc. So a lot of the subjects are already kind of trite or have been already discussed. So sometimes I try to come up with something that hasn't been discussed. And it dawned on me that we have a wonderful situation today, which I know I didn't have as a child, which is that we have so many grandparents, great-grandparents, and, you know, so we have a situation where there are, you know, where you have to relate to older children. But they often tell, I mean, I grew up in a neighborhood which was almost all immigrants and survivors. I had an elderly grandfather. It was like a novelty. I mean, it was like, really, people thought he was, like, funny because there were so few of them. But I remember I had one friend who had American-born parents, and he once went home and asked his parents how come they speak English funny, because they're the only ones that didn't speak with an accent. But today, really, kind of harder. We have a lot of that situation. We also have a situation, which we're going to talk about a little bit, where there's a prolonged dependence on parents. So you really have people in their 20s, 30s, sometimes even beyond that, who are still financially and in other ways dependent upon their parents. So this is, I think, a topic that we need to talk about. But the interesting thing was, when I first thought of this topic, the subject, the name I called it was Parenting a Grown-Up Child. And to my amazement and chagrin, very few people showed up to my workshop. And what came out was that people thought I was talking about lo aleinu, a child who's developmentally delayed or something like that, and having to parent that child. The topic was so alien that people didn't even think I was just talking about more normal, typical situations. So we changed the topic subject to you never stop being a parent relating to a grown-up child. So people understand I'm talking about the more normative, general situation of just relating to your grown-up children, and for that matter, for us grown-up children relating to our parents. So I'm going to bring up a few subjects, but I want to share also one more interesting thought that I know I had growing up. There's a saying, it's in Yiddish, it's in Italian, it's almost in every language: little children, little problems; big children, big problems. Now, when I had little children, I could never understand that. You know, first of all, everywhere you went, you had to take the carriage and the diapers, and it was so hard to move about. They cried. You didn't know what they were saying. A grown-up kid can take care of themselves. They can express themselves. I figured it must be so much easier to have grown-up children. Now that I have grown-up children, I understand the saying. Because why is it the big children, big problems? Because you love them just as much, and you only have a fraction of the leverage. A little kid, you can take them by the nape of their neck and put them there, punish them, control them. When you have grown-up children, you have just as much love and just as much concern, and you still know everything better than they do, and you don't have the control. So it really becomes like an art and a skill how you parent a grown-up child. So you really still are a parent, but the style and the way in which you parent is very different. And by the way, when I did a lit search or Googled this subject, there's practically nothing. So we're kind of forging new territory. Okay, so first thing is, let me talk about a very sensitive subject, and that's money. Okay, because we do have this kind of prolonged dependence. In fact, I once went to a bris, and the grandfather of the baby was asked a question. He said, we say in a bris, k'shem shenitnas bris, kein tikanas l'tor l'chupim masim tovim. Just like a kid that had a bris, he's going to go to Torah, he's going to the chupa. He said, the kid's 8 days old. We're talking about Chinese with Torah and the chupa. He says, now that he's a grandfather, he finally understands. K'shem shenitnas bris. Just like the grandfather paid for the bris, he's going to pay for the bar mitzvah, he's going to pay for the wedding. You know, so now he understands why we say that at a bris, But, the truth of the matter is, and the circumstances are such, as I said, there is this prolonged dependence. And parents are very often financially helping out the grown-up child. So, just a few points about that, okay? Number one, if you give money, whatever you give, give graciously. Whatever you decide not to give, don't give. The worst thing to do is to half give. The worst thing to do is to say, all right, I'm going to help you buy the house. I wanted to retire this year. I guess I'm going to have to work a little longer. Or, all right, we'll just have to forego that vacation we wanted to take and make the kid feel miserable when you're giving to them. And it is sometimes demeaning for a 30, 40-year-old to have to ask their parents for assistance. if you can do it, and you can't always, you shouldn't overextend yourself. You have to consider your future. You have to consider your needs. My only point is, not saying that you have to give boundlessly, but when you give, that should be give graciously. You should just give, even if it hurts, even if it is hard, and even if you are sacrificing something, it's sort of like giving a nut. It's like almost, I mean, shouldn't say it's a shoe, but like a Judas kiss. You know, it's like giving and not giving at the same time. So if you give, then give. Can we like wait till the end because my Ritalin's going to wear off and then I'm going to and we'll take questions, okay? And sometimes you have to cut back. You know, the Ger Rebbe once said that he's waiting for that last einikel, that last grandchild. What does he mean? Somebody's killing themselves. They're working really hard. Why are they working so hard? For the children. So now you have enough money for yourself and the children. Why are you working so hard? For the grandchildren. So then why is the kid working so hard? For his grandchildren. So he says he's waiting for that last grandchild who's going to get all that money, you know, that they're all working for so much for. So sometimes you have to hold back. Sometimes you give. But my point is, when you say no, no is no. When you say yes, it should be a wholehearted yes. And that also applies to other things that you help with, such as babysitting. And babysitting is a unique role for grandparents. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But again, babysitting or helping out or helping take care of the kids. Again, most young people today, in order to make it, they have to have two working parents. So sometimes the grandparents' role become very important in terms of helping with child care. What you do, do it graciously. Don't krechs. Don't say, oi, I really didn't want to. Oh, I was going to get together with my friend. I guess I'll have to. If you want to get together with your friend, say no. And you can say no. In fact, sometimes saying no makes your yeses more meaningful. If you're saying yes all the time, then your yeses don't mean anything. Select, choose. But what you do, again, should be done graciously. One more thing also in terms of, in fact, I'm actually, when I think about this, the babysitting thing, I'll tell a personal story. I've kind of heard my parents are well in their 80s and they're doing well, and I'm very blessed in that respect. But I remember the very last time that they babysat for my children for a weekend. We went away to a weekend bar mitzvah. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that was the weekend when my 12-year-old son gave my 9-year-old son a shower, fully dressed. Figured, you know, this way he can clean his clothing and his body at the same time. But my parents, when we came home, were standing by the door with their luggage. They were in such a rush to leave that my father put the luggage down behind the car, pulled out and ran over his luggage. And I'm watching this, I'm saying, they ain't doing this again, you know. But that's, you know, again, do what you can, not more than you can. But one more point when you babysit. Don't take over. In other words, it's very important that the actual parents, that their role is preserved, even though you know better what to do. And we'll talk about later how you advise children and how you teach your grown-up child. But the role of a grandparent in taking care of children is the deputy of the parents. If a child has to be disciplined, you have to tell them, Mommy's not, I'm going to have to tell Mommy or Dad, I'm going to have to tell Daddy when I come home. Or let's say the parents say you can, if they don't do this and this, they can't have dessert. Say it b'shem amro. Say it in the name of the person. Your mother said you can't have dessert unless you eat the main meal. Don't make it you. You're not the authority. Your grandparent role is a unique role. We'll talk about it later a little bit. But that's not your role to be a surrogate parent, even if you can do it better, and even if you think your children are too lenient. You take your cue from them, and then if whatever you're doing as a babysitter, you're doing it in their name. You're delegating. If the kids are really out of hand, then you're just going to tell Mommy and Daddy. You have to keep them in that role. And as I said, when you give with self-respect. It is humiliating. When you give, don't make the kid feel lousy. Don't say, if kids come for help, let's say even financial help, say, Samadhi, you're not making enough? Samadhi, are you working hard enough? You sure you're not? I mean, that's not giving. If you think they're not, and you think that they need the experience of missing something in order to work harder, then just don't give. But I said, once you give, then do it the right way and do it with self-respect. And that, by the way, raises another very important issue, which is, again, a reality of our times. And that's when you take a child or a son or daughter-in-law into your business. And let me paint a scenario for this, and I've seen this. I'm talking about things I've seen in my office. You have somebody who built up a business, okay? And the way people build up a business, you know, starting with nothing, breaking their back, working really hard, it grows, it's their life. They know the product inside out, it's their business, you know, right? And then you take in the son, you take in the son-in-law. It's very hard when for all their lives they're in so-and-so's business. It's not theirs. Or when it's somehow conveyed, and I've seen this, by the way, in families I've worked with, where even the children, the grandchildren, know that it's not your business, so they almost have a little respect for you. They say, oh, it's grandpa's business anyway. It's grandma's business anyway. and they don't have respect for you. If you take a child into the business, and it's a very hard thing to do, because when you build up something from nothing, you have a tremendous attachment to it. You have to let them carve their niche. You have to let them have their branch of the business, if you will, or maybe expand it so that the child, I mean, ultimately, first they may have to learn it, but you have to let go and hand it over, and you may have to let go in such a way that they do it their way. You know, they may want to do it on the internet, and to you, the internet's some mysterious place that you can't quite figure out. You have to let them, and maybe they'll fail, and nothing wrong with failing. Sometimes you learn a lot from failing. But if they are forever in your business, or if you are forever correcting them, or if you are forever demonstrating because it's very hard for you to let go, that's degrading to the person, and the person won't be successful either. So again, it's a touchy thing. But if you take someone into business, let them carve their own niche, let them have their own place. Now, what if they are doing something wrong, okay? What happens if your 30-year-old, 40, 50-year-old kid, for that matter, is doing something wrong, whether it's in the business, whether it's raising the children, whether how they're conducting their lives? How do you parent them? How do you correct them? Again, if it's a 12-year-old, you know, you send them to their room. You know, if you don't like who your 6-year-old is playing with, they can't play with them. If you don't like who your 36-year-old is hanging out with, there's not much you can do. So first of all, don't dictate, but suggest. Couch what you want to say in questions. Again, preserving their respect as adults. You might say to them, did you ever consider maybe this and this and this? Maybe it's not my place to say it because I'm not living, but I just want to share with you a thought I had. Or I remember when I was your age and I was in a situation like this, I found this and this to be helpful. It's up to you. You're the adult. In other words, you don't back off. You don't not involve yourself, but now you present, but you don't dictate an order about either. You're now couching it in questions. You're proposing something. You may want to lead them that direction. Maybe there's another way to do this. Or, you know, they're having a problem. The grandchild is not being disciplined enough. Instead of telling them that, say to them, you know, it's not working out. You consider some other ways, some other approaches. Would it be very old-fashioned on my part to suggest such and such and such and such? Again, you're suggesting, you're leading, you're steering them in a certain direction, but you're not dictating. I'll tell you something that it's almost very similar, a situation I was in once. I got a call from a parent who has a child who is just very shy. Some children are just inherently, genetically very shy. And his teacher is someone who has been teaching fourth grade boys for about 83 years now and doesn't want to know from psychologists. And she was going to break him. And the mother was frantic. So I called up this teacher. I already knew her. And I said to her, look, the mother came to me with this kid. And he's very shy and doesn't speak up in class. So one of two possibilities. Either he's just inherently very shy, or maybe he's just refusing to speak up and he needs, and it's two very different approaches. You know fourth grade boys better than anyone else. You've been teaching fourth grade boys forever and ever. Do me a favor, observe him for 2 weeks and let me know. And then she came back and said, yeah, I think it's just inherent. I think, thank you, it was very helpful, the whole problem was solved. In other words, I didn't dictate to her because I knew she wouldn't listen to me, but I tried to lead her in that direction. It's the same thing we do with grown-up children. And by the way, even if they ask, you know, sometimes we think if somebody asks us for advice, that's they really want it. First of all, 90% of the time people ask us for advice, they know exactly what they want to hear. You know, I mean, I remember even my grandfather, Vashalom, he was a Yekka, and he would ask my father for advice. My father knew what he wanted to hear, and sometimes my father was annoyed with him. He'd tell him what he didn't want to hear, and he turned red in the face. I don't know if anyone knows German, because I'm not sure if I remember it clearly, but it was something like, "Diese Rate wollte ich nicht," you know, that's not the advice I wanted, you know. Most of the time people want to hear what they want to hear. So again, even if somebody asks, you have to lead them in that direction or propose it, but always acknowledge that they're in the best position and they're the ones who have to make the ultimate decision. And then, by the way, there's probably what is the most difficult thing for any parent to do, which is sometimes let the child learn, and by the way, this goes for younger children, but certainly for older children, which is the school of hard knocks. It's to hold back, you see, you know what they're doing is wrong. You know it, or even in business, let's say, with a kid in the bed, you know it's not going to work. You know if you say something, even remotely, that it's just going to boomerang in your face, and you got to let them learn their own way and learn a hard way. I want to tell you something I was very moved by once. Someone was once told me in my office that when her first child was born, they brought her the baby, and she took one look at the baby, and she started to cry. And everybody assumed she was crying because she was touched and moved by having her first child. So that's what was going on. She looked at the child, and she thought of all the things that are going to happen to this kid that she's not going to know about. And she cried about that. And I thought it was so brilliant. This is the truth. You know, you don't, especially as they get older. There's less and less that you know about. There's less and less that goes on in their lives that you have a handle on. And it's hard as a parent, but that's the reality, that as they get older, they learn things, they do things, that some of which we don't even know about. And the truth of the matter is also, and this is a fact I'm sure has been borne out by all of us who've lived any life, what you learn yourself, what you learn from your own experience, what you learn from failure has much more meaning than what you've been taught. I know when I do supervision with residents and interns, I tell them, my first day speech, I tell them, please make mistakes. Because I found that the resident or the interns who make mistakes learn. The ones who are so scared to make a mistake, they don't do anything good, they don't do anything bad. You learn from your mistakes. And sometimes you have to sit back and let them fail and let them flounder. Because from this, they will learn. In fact, the Gemara says in Bava Metzia that Adam Ratzah B'Kav Shelo Mitisha Kavim Shel Chaveiro. That somebody wants one measurement of something that's their own, the 9 that was given to them by somebody else. And the same thing is true with life's lessons. That sometimes you just have to sit back, watch it happen, watch it unfold, and let the child learn for himself. And I don't think there's anything more difficult when it comes to parenting the grown-up child. Another important point, and again, I think this is, I'm bringing stuff, you know, from the work I've done, from what I've seen in my office, and that's dealing with disappointment. You know, our rabbis tell us that when Avraham Avinu died, when Abraham died, he died b'seiva tova. He died in a good old age, I guess. And it says he had no regrets. He died without regrets. If the rabbis had to tell us that Abraham died without regrets, it means the rest of us are dying with regrets. Nothing ever works out exactly the way we want. None of our children turn out exactly the way we want. And as long as they're little kids, we still think they can change. You know, they'll outgrow it. They'll get over it. When they're married, the wife will set them straight, you know, something. Or when they have children, they'll understand. You know, we keep, you know, once they reach a certain age, you kind of realize, you know what? They're not going to be, and let's hope they are mostly what you want, or maybe in some respects surpassing your dreams. But in some respects, you'll be disappointed. Nobody ever turns out. And that's part, again, of the challenge of relating to a grown-up child, is that you have to come to terms with ways in which they may have turned out that was not exactly everything you wanted. And then there's another, if you will, trap, another thing we have to be very careful about. And that's wanting your child to fill, how should I put it, wanting your child to do for you what you haven't done yourself. Which is, again, it's something we call, in the profession, we call it vicarious living. Very often, especially if you haven't had an opportunity. Suppose you wanted to be a professional, and life circumstances were such, you couldn't. So this is, and this gnaws away at you. It's something that's missing. So you're going to pressure your child like crazy to become a professional because you didn't. Maybe your kid isn't cut out to be a professional, and maybe that's not what he wants to do. And it's one thing if we, and again, it's very tricky because sometimes we think, you know, we rationalize ourselves. We do all sorts of mind tricks. So we say to ourselves, it's really for his best interest. I'm doing this for him because I want him to have a career, blah, 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 blah. But in actuality, you're doing it for yourself. Or it could be that, you always wanted to sit and learn and go to yeshiva, and you didn't have a chance. Now you're pushing your kid to go to yeshiva because you didn't. That's a trap you have to be very careful. And again, as you get older and you see opportunities narrowing, there's less and less chances to accomplish certain things, you may turn to your, how are you, Rebecca? May turn to your children to fill up those gaps, to fill those voids. And that's a very dangerous thing. You have to be very careful about that. But there can be other way around also. And there's something that happens very often, even with grown-up, not uncommonly with grown-up children, which is when children scapegoat the parents for areas that are unfair. I'll explain what scapegoating is in a minute, okay? Scapegoating actually comes from the Torah. And those of you know from the Yom Kippur service that there was a goat that was thrown off a cliff and carried the sins of the Jewish people. That has crept into English to become a term called scapegoating. Scapegoating basically is taking out your own frustrations on someone else unwarranted, or just because the person maybe remotely reminds you of those frustrations, etc. So you take it out on someone else instead of facing it yourself. So just like the goat takes the sins, you pick somebody to bear your iniquities, to bear your sins. Now, sometimes when a child, and I'm talking about even a grown offspring, is frustrated, is unhappy, is not fulfilled in some way, and even if it has absolutely nothing or practically nothing to do with you, very often, it's a sad thing and it shouldn't be this way, but parents are often scapegoated. Parents are scapegoated for a number of reasons. First of all, we can thank the founder of my profession, Sigmund Freud, for that, because Sigmund Freud was a mother abuser. Sigmund Freud, I mean, look, he did a lot of good. I mean, you know, I'm making a living because of him, so I'm not going to, you know, have to, you know, I can't, you know, but he, you know, the thinking at the time was parents, and particularly mothers, were at much to blame for how kids turned out. We know this isn't true. I mean, there's countless situations, theories, that actually did a lot of harm. Parents would have a kid with emotional problems, and as if that weren't heart-wrenching enough, and then they go to some fancy-looking professional and says, well, it's all your fault. So we have this, and this has crept into our thinking so much that very often parents are culprits or seen as culprits for things that they really had very little control over. But also, and again, it almost sounds cruel to say this, but if there's one person in the world whom you can dump on, treat with spite, etc., and the person will still love you, it's your mother and your father, but more your mother, I'd say, even. In fact, the rabbis knew this. There's a halacha, there's a law brought in the Torah, something called Abava Machteres. Abava Machteres is a situation where if somebody is crawling into your cellar, it means. In other words, someone's breaking into your house. According to Jewish law, on the chance, there's a good, you know, on the belief that this person could kill you, you're allowed to kill that person in self-defense. It's called Abava Machteres. The Talmud says in Sanhedrin a very interesting thing. If a son is crawling into his father's house, as a robber, the father can kill the son, because the son would kill the father. But if the father's crawling into the son's house, the son's not allowed to kill the father, because the father would never kill the son. So they knew it. But unfortunately, sometimes you become the target of their frustrations. And you are blamed, and you are yelled at, and sometimes even ostracized. And I've had situations also where parents, and it's terribly painful, where ties have been severed with a child, sometimes for something nominal, sometimes for some wrongdoing, but it certainly doesn't warrant that degree. And I have to tell you something else that I've seen is that if they persist with that, and ultimately if the parent passes away and there isn't a relationship, the child suffers from that too. But it's a terrible situation, and again, unless a parent's a horrible, abusive person, but very often the parents are the ones that are scapegoated for the frustrations, and you have to be careful about that. And sometimes you can get caught up in that. Again, because of the love and devotion to the child. So the child's attacking you and blaming you for this, that, and the other thing, and you're defending yourself, and you're apologizing, and you're starting to question yourself about whether you were really such a terrible parent. The vast majority of us are very good parents. And if you're subject to that, the best thing is really just not to respond to it, is to try to steer clear of it, because it really has nothing to do with anything that you did. There's another situation that occurs, again, to parents in that period of life. And that's the shift in terms of focus. If we were to trace, let's say, the development of a parent or a family, you first get married, your focus is almost on just you and the spouse, pretty much. Along come children, mortgages, yeshiva tuitions, summer camps. Before you know it, you're both busy with just about everything except each other. Let's say if we're a little bit more stereotypical home, so the mother's busy with the kids and you're busy with we have four jobs to pay for everything. And there's almost like a moving away. I mean, you're still married and you still talk and you still connect, but your lives are such that there's almost like just fleeting moments with you and your spouse. Kids, thank God, grow up, get married, move out pretty much on their own. Of course, never on their own, but much more on their own. You're either retiring or now cutting back on your work, and suddenly you have to get reintroduced to your spouse. It's 30, 40 years later, and suddenly it's the two of you again. And this is a tough adjustment. I mean, I have to tell you, the people, it's a very interesting thing about retirement. It's not that subject. But people, you know, spend years and years dreaming about retiring, and when it comes, they're not so happy. I've made some money on this. You know, it's a huge adjustment, a tremendous. Part of the adjustment is your change in your role, your activity level, et cetera. But part of it is also, suddenly you're married again, you know, and you relate to your spouse. And most people make that adjustment, and they get sort of reacquainted. They start enjoying each other again, and it can work out very nicely. Sometimes, if that's not working out so well, if that reacquaintance is not working out so well, you're going to try to cling to what you had. You're going to continue working or look for work when you really shouldn't be working anymore, when your health maybe dictates that you shouldn't be working anymore, you don't need it anymore. Or you may turn to the kids. That gets us back to our subject. Where you may start trying to get much more involved with the children, almost to reclaim that period when your life was very much focused on the kids. And again, that's a trap you have to be careful about. Also, again, that may be even at a later stage, but you also will find that very awkward situation where at some point you may be more dependent on the children for whatever, in terms of care or in terms of managing this world. Something that's an interesting phenomenon, again, not related to us here, but for those of you maybe like myself who grew up in a community of immigrants or had immigrant parents, that when a family immigrates to another country, usually the children adjust much more quickly, and there's a sudden shift in the roles. Or suddenly the children have to take care of the children, have to take the parents down to the voting booth and read it for them or something like that. And you have that kind of shift in dependency, which can happen very rapidly in a situation such as that. But you may have a situation where, if not financially, but in terms of navigating the world, et cetera, or managing or fixing things in the house, where there's a shift in dependency. And again, that may be hard. Maybe hard for you. It's also, by the way, probably hard for your child, because you know it's your daddy, it's your mommy, and again, that's an adjustment where you may meet up with some resistance. You might call your kid to come over and do something, and he may say something like, "Why can't you do it yourself?" Not meaning to be disrespectful, not meaning to be rude, but having a hard time with that transition to the point that they're now becoming somewhat caretakers for the people who are their ultimate caretakers. A few more points, and now I hear people have things to say, so we'll hopefully have a little discussion, because that's also part of what we're supposed to be doing here. There's another thing that happens sometimes, again, to parents of grown-up children. You know, the rabbis tell us, and says, Vayeshev Yaakov. You know, when Yaakov said, right before the whole thing happened with his son Yosef, rabbis say, Ratza Yaakov Loshevet Seva, V'kofetz Olav Yosef, that he wanted to take it easy. Yaakov had a, you think we had a hard life. I mean, he really had a lot, you know, thrown out of his house, he had to deal with Lavan, he had to, you know, his daughter was kidnapped, you know, he had battles, he had his brother. I mean, he had a very rough life. He was old, he wanted to take it, he lost his wife already, he wanted to take it easy. He wanted to take it easy. And I always felt that when I saw that it was like, the rabbis were a little critical, if you can say such a thing, that you think you're going to take it easy. As long as you're living, as long as you're breathing, there are going to be challenges. And sometimes that's very hard. You know, you reach a certain point, you raised your kids, you paid all the tuitions, you got them through medical school, you pay for their wedding, you got them all established, they're on their own. Now you can wipe your brow and take it easy. And what happens? He loses his job. You got to help him, right? He has a new job, he has a commute, he needs help taking care of the kids, the grandchild is now acting up in school, and they don't know what to do, and you're sort of like saying, like, enough already, you know? I mean, I paid my dues. It doesn't work that way in life, and that's sometimes very hard. You know, it's once, while you're in the thick of things, while you're raising the children, you're almost like embattled and ready for disappointments and headaches, etc. When it happens at that point, you almost feel like, you know, when does it stop? You know, there's a story that someone once came also to the Ger Rebbe and said to him, you know, I can't handle my tzuris anymore. And he said, God should spare you from the tzuris you can handle. Nishke Pristveren, I think, was my mother used to say, you know, if those of you know Yiddish. But it's that happens. And that's something also a very hard adjustment at that point. Let me talk a little bit about daughters and son-in-laws. Right, you know the famous line, what do you do if you miss your mother-in-law? Reload and aim again. Reload and aim again. If you miss your mother-in-law, reload and aim again. All right. But okay. I guess that's a New York joke because I thought it hasn't gotten out here. You know. I don't talk that. I'm sorry. It's New Yorkers. I can tell you. I should have said if you miss your daughter-in-law, right? Yeah. Any rate, let me explain to you what happens with daughters-in-law, sons-in-law, etc. We often say in the field that a family is what we call a system. And what do we mean by a system? A system means that it's like a well-oiled machine. You all have your roles. You do it so naturally you don't realize it. But everybody has a role, and everybody plays a part. And it's like, you know, and you can see, I mean, if you visit someone, especially if you're not coming, when you come as a guest, sometimes they, you know, people back off a little bit. But let's say if you spend some time with a, you're on a business trip and you spend some time at a friend's house and you know, after a while you see they have a whole way of operating. They have a whole way of connecting. It's like a dance. In fact, one good way to demonstrate this, I mean, I know that I can relate to this and other people have told me, when a new child is born, suddenly the whole system has to shift now. There's different alliances, et cetera. It takes a while for family to get into a new dance. Or if a child moves out, goes off to Israel or gets married, now suddenly there's a whole reshifting. But you have sort of a way of operating. When someone marries your child and comes into the family, they're coming with their system. And they're out of sorts. They don't quite fit in. And it really, and sometimes we don't realize that. And it's very hard for them, especially they come for the first meals, etc. And you have to keep in mind that until you're at home with each other, until you've worked out a new system to accommodate this person, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, and sometimes that can lead to tension. I mean, it's hard for that person who is sort of the outside. I'm sure we can all relate to that for the first time that we had dinner with our, our future in-laws, etc., or whatever. That is a very hard thing. So you have to back off, give them some time, make accommodations until they feel comfortable. It's not even necessarily personal, until they feel comfortable in the way that you guys operate. And also, by the way, that can happen as well when your children have their own family. Then they're going to develop their own quote-unquote system. And sometimes, again, you may feel out of place. Now, suddenly the way you used to relate to your children is now unfamiliar. There's a whole new way of connecting and relating. That's what's supposed to happen. Each family has their sort of unwritten rules. Another, by the way, trap, which I've seen in this particular place. Come on, you have to sit in the front when you come late, you know. No, this seat, sir. You're not understanding. Rather than be near the teacher, you know? What are these guys doing here? Yeah. Something else, an interesting phenomenon that I've seen again, especially if your children are living out of town or in Israel, which is already a fairly common phenomenon. What happens, again, many of us have children who have made Aliyah and are living, of course, in Beit Shemesh, because I'm not Beit Shemesh, because it's going to be the 52nd state of the United States, you know. It's, the official language there is English now, I understand. But what happens now, so you're very far away. Let's say you talk on the phone and you email it, but then you go for a visit. So you go from, like, distance to suddenly being on top of each other intensely for a very short time. And you want to be, because you miss the grandchildren, you miss the children. So you move in, like, because usually, again, if your kids live in another neighborhood here in Chicago, you're not moving in. You're dropping in, you're visiting. Now suddenly you're moving in, and you're on top of each other. And you're doing everything, you're trying to maximize the time together, because they only have 10 days together. And it can be too much. And sometimes, it can be overbearing for the parents. And for the kids, disruptive to the kids also. But sometimes, even though it's a hard thing, sometimes you're better off not moving in. Sometimes, or if you have moved in, to see them, spend time with them every other day and go do some things yourself. Ease it in a little bit, even though, again, it's very hard for you because you're here and you finally get to see them. But sometimes those very intense, brief visits are very difficult. Let me talk about, and again, it's a more unfortunate situation, which I hope is not applicable, but again, the reality of today is the reality of today. What happens if your child is having marital problems or having problems at home or is having difficulties with a child? But let's focus primarily on marital problems, okay? It's a very tricky thing, and I'll tell you why. If it's a type of problem that can be resolved and fixed, the best thing you can do is stay out of it. The moment you meddle, the moment you get involved, even if you're siding with your son-in-law or daughter-in-law, even if you think that you know that your child is the one who's wrong, etc., once you mix in, no matter how well-intended you are, no matter how accurate you are, that's one thing you stay out of. And if you want to get involved, best thing you can say is, I'll pay for the marital therapist, but that's about it, you know. Do not get involved. As a marital therapist, I wanted to put that plug in, you know. No, wait a second. I'll talk to you in a second. Questions later. Now, here's the tricky piece, why I say it's so tricky. If, God forbid, a divorce happens, then you're needed. Because one of the things we've certainly observed is, and a divorce, it's not, you know, not the end of the world. People survive divorces. But if a divorce happens, they're going to need you more than they've ever needed you before. And the divorcees that do get through it are usually the ones whose family and friends have rallied behind them. Not rallied necessarily, even siding. I'm not saying to take sides, but helping them with the finances, helping them now with having to be a single parent, etc. So if you're in a situation like this, it's almost like it's an all or nothing kind of thing. If it's fixable, or if it's at the point where there's some difficulties, but the marriage not being dissolved, your best thing is to stay out of it. If it comes to the point where there's a separation or a divorce, you're going to be very badly needed. And again, as I said, the worst cases are very often the ones in situations like this who don't have family or friends to back them up, and then they're really on their own. And those are the ones that often fall apart. And one last point, and I think we're doing okay time-wise. I want to read something from Salvage. I think it was very beautiful, and then maybe we'll conclude with that. Don't ever feel, let's say everything's working great. Your kids are making a good living, they don't need your money. The grandchildren are all picture perfect and doing wonderful, all right? The marriage, the kids' marriages are wonderful. Your retirement is great. You've never realized how gorgeous and wonderful and handsome your spouse is. I mean, everything's going great. And you might feel, and this again, you might feel superfluous. You might feel, now what function do I serve? It could be the other extreme. I'm not needed. I'm just a burden. And that's something that you have to be careful about, because we as grandparents or those who have the connection to the previous generation are very important, especially in our world. And our world is Orthodox Jews. And that's something that's very lacking, I think, in the world in general. For example, in the world at large, we have a very youth-oriented society. And what do I mean? Children are being made disproportionately important. Young people are being made disproportionately important, and older people are being made unimportant. If you watch the TV shows, if you read the popular literature, children are usually brilliant, resourceful, incredible people. Parents are nincompoops, and elderly people are these silly people who are burdens. That's not the way it is. And that's the way it's supposed to be, and that's not the way our religion is. We revere the elderly because they're closer and more connected to our past, which is so important, and our Masorah, which is so important. In fact, very often, I mean, some people dispute this, but my impression has been that many Balei Tshuva, many people become religious. The reason they become religious is to be part of something, because they feel disconnected, part of a community, but also part of a tradition. And that can be a very important role, and you have to play that role. You have to tell the grandchildren, or for that matter, the great-grandchildren, about your grandparents and where you came from, and connect them to the past, because then there's a sense of belonging. It was in that spirit that I wanted to read to you something that I think is one of the most beautiful pieces, and I think this being a Yeshiva University, partially Yeshiva University-sponsored event, it's worthwhile to quote Rav Soloveitchik, who is the mentor and the Rebbe of Yeshiva University. And some of you may have seen this piece. It's been reprinted in other books, but I took it from Man of Faith in the Modern World by Rabbi Bezdin. But it's Rabbi Soloveitchik describes what it's like to be giving a shiur to such young people when he's an older man. And it's a beautiful piece. It's worth it just to read. So if you can bear with me, I'll read it. And then with that, we'll take some questions. The old Rebbe walks into the classroom crowded with students who are young enough to be his grandchildren. He enters as an old man with wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. The Rebbe is seated and sees before him rows of young, beaming faces, clear eyes radiating with the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism, with tremors of uncertainty. He asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students, between a Rebbe in his Indian summer and students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts the shiur, uncertain as to how it will proceed. Suddenly, the door opens, and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, enters. He is the grandfather of the Rebbe, Reb Chaim Briska, 1853 to 1918. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics were it not for his method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, or philosophy. The door opens again, and another old man comes in. He is older than Reb Chaim, for he lived in the 17th century. His name is Rashab Taikon, known as the Shach, who must be present when civil law, Dine Mamonos, is discussed. Many more visitors arrive, and some from the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. Others harken back to antiquity, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rambam, Ravid, Rashba, Rabbi Akiva, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. The Rebbe introduced the guests to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states a halacha. The Ravid disagrees sharply, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Ravid, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students and suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. All speak one language, all pursue one goal, all are committed to a common vision, and all operate with the same categories. A Masorah, collegiality is achieved, a friendship, a comradeship, of old and young, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages and modern times. The Huakates, this joining of generations, this merging of identities, will ultimately bring about the redemption of the Jewish people. It will fulfill the words of the last Hebrew prophet Malachi, and he shall turn the hearts of their fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers. The messianic realization will witness the great dialogue of generations. After 2 and 3 hour shia, the Rebbe emerges from the chamber young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment, dry, and wrinkled, embrace warm, supple hands in a commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus, the, quote, old ones of past continue the great dialogue of the generations, ensuring enduring commitment to Masorah, the Huakates, and this is a secret that will lead to the Messianic redemption. Okay, let me, questions, go ahead, yeah.
You opened up discussing giving.
Right.
Time or money, and you presented two ends. One was to give graciously, and the other is to load on the guilt. But surely, when you are giving, and it is difficult for you to give, there has to be an element of putting on the guilt. I mean, how do you go through this balance?
No, you sit down with, listen, you want to feel guilty, you sit down with your wife and deal with your guilt. You decide so between,
wait. You know as well that you're putting yourself out to do something.
Yeah, if it's too much, don't do it.
No, but there are, it could be anyway. Anything.
If it's too much, listen, you have to sometimes say no. If you never say no, then your yeses are meaningless. You have to say no. All I'm saying is, say yes, say no. Don't say yes, but. That's the worst way to give. That's the worst way to give. When you give to someone, it's the same thing as the true laws of charity. You know, go through the Maimonides and laws of charity. The best charity is when you preserve the other person's dignity. When the person doesn't know who it's coming from, and you don't know who you're giving it to. Or actually, the best one is even give them a job. You got to preserve, when you give to someone, you got to preserve their dignity. So if you're giving, give with a smile on your face. You give to them and say, of course, that's why I've worked. It's my pleasure. If it's too much, say no. Or you can say, look, I can do this much. I can't do more. I can make you this wedding. I can make you this wedding. We'll make it as beautiful as possible. But that which you give, you don't give. Ay vey. And you know, and all right, so I'll go to the mafia and I'll borrow it, and then maybe they'll break my knees, you know. That's not how you give, you know. Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
What if you sense that the recipient is not appreciative of that?
Are they trying to make you feel guilty?
All right. Yeah, I mean, that's a problem. You know the famous line, there was a famous Hasidic Rav who said, oh, he wanted to change the world. You know the famous line? Well, he said he wanted to change the world. When he was young, he wanted to change the world. He got older, he realized he can't change the world, so he figured he'll change his town. He got older, he realized he couldn't change his town, so he decided he was going to change his family. He got older, he realized he couldn't change his family, he decided to change himself. And then he says, as I changed, my family changed, my town changed, and the world changed. You can't control them, you know, not necessarily. You can control yourself. So if they make you feel guilty, that's their problem. You know, you give what you can. If you know you're doing the right thing, and you know what you have cheshbonos also in terms of other children. You can't, you know, sometimes not, it can't always be 100% fair. Some people have different needs. I mean, you know, but you have other children, and you have your older years, etc. So you put that all into the ledger, and you know you're giving as generously as you can. The guilt trip is their problem, not yours. Then you have to be fortified, and that's, by the way, also where your spouse. I'll tell you in a second. That's where your spouse comes in. You got to clear it first with yourselves. Well, that's the point. What they do, they're wrong. Of course, they shouldn't make you feel guilty. That's. But that's when I talk about raising your parents. I'll talk to them about that. Yeah, you had some portals.
I'm a yeshiva graduate.
Yeah.
I'm class of 49. I'm 71 years old. I have 3 children. The eldest is a daughter, and then 2 boys. And at this point in my life, I feel very tired.
Uh-huh. Because you're a yeshiva graduate.
I'm very rigid as a result of training. I'm very rigid. The daughter of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the children of an immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
They are very fluid, I would say. And, you know, I have come to the conclusion that the best way to deal with them is not to hear very well, not to see very well, and also...
That's why my mother does it. Oh! I'm going to call her right away.
And also... also to disregard a good deal of what is said as emotional baggage from the year one.
Yeah, that's right. You're 100% right.
If I sat in a psychotherapy session with my daughter, she was on the couch and I was on a chair, I wouldn't know what she's talking about, to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh, that happens.
And when she brings up, she's one of these people who bring up year one.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's talking about. I don't want to know what she's talking about. I'm tired.
And what can you do about it?
I just last week decided she's one of the most boring people I know. Now, what if such a thing happens to a parent that they decide that a person they gave birth to is one of the most boring people they know? For example.
Blame it on your husband.
Three years ago, I was at her house for Thanksgiving, and beneath the dado in the dining room, she put as decoration designer bags. I said to her, "You know, I'm ashamed of you, and the people who will walk in here that you are, are your guests." Will think you're nuts. I had to say it because, my values are so different.
Okay, let me ask you a question. I don't want to get into very personal things, yeah. But when you say something, again, maybe I'll quote Rav Soloveitchik. Remember when Rav Soloveitchik wrote The Lonely Man of Faith, which was his magnum opus, someone immediately translated it into Hebrew. I mean, before the ink wouldn't even dry yet. And someone asked him what he thought of the translation. And he said, a translator has to know two things well. He has to know English well, and he has to know English well. This guy doesn't know English, and he doesn't know Hebrew. When you speak to somebody, there has to be a communicator and has to be a listener.
Yes, and that's audience.
Right. So if the person is not going to hear you, you're better off not saying anything.
Well, she doesn't know that.
Well, you know that.
I
don't want to get into personal things, but I'm just saying, very often that applies to children, it applies to neighbors, it applies to spouses. If somebody can't hear you, I have a rabbi friend who likes to say that a fish would never get caught if it kept its mouth shut. Sometimes you're better keeping your mouth shut. Sometimes, if they're not going to hear, even if you're right, Yeah, go ahead in the back.
What age would you start making that transition between that young adult and that adult child? And would you get that young adult accustomed to the way you would go ahead and handle the situation prior mm-hmm. for that? Making their own.
How old am I again?
And the second response to that big Shemesh family that you're having problems with, you can refer to my apartment, we'll kind of deal with it.
Okay, all right. Actually, it's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea to rent an apartment nearby, if you can afford it. I mean, that's a very nice, you're not on top of each other, and you can go back, and it's not a bad solution. But again, it's a financial consideration also, so this can be very expensive. But I'm just saying, if you can, that's sometimes a smoother way to orchestrate those kind of visits. Very hard to talk about ages nowadays because, it has more to do, I think, with life circumstances than an actual age. I don't think you can say it's 24, 25. First of all, we've prolonged this adolescence because today most of our children go into professions. And by the time you finish college, graduate school, internship, residency, you can be in your 30s already. So we have this very prolonged sort of dependence. I don't think there's a cutoff either. I think in most circumstances, it happens gradually. It happens piecemeal. Okay, whatever that means. Okay, I got it, yeah. I think that just meant you got a big mouth and we're never inviting you back. I think that's what he just said. But I can't give you an age, but it's a transition. And you know what else can happen, by the way? Life circumstances are such that you can make a lot of headway in that direction and something can happen. I gave an extreme example in a situation of a divorce where suddenly the child is extremely dependent upon you. And doesn't have to be anything that radical. Life circumstances are such a grandchild can have a lot of problems that is consuming the parents. And now suddenly they're not able as much to handle it on their own, and they need the grandparents to come and pitch it. So you can't, Ratzah Yaakov Shev Zaseva. You can't wipe your brow. You never know what God has in mind for us. So I can't say, so it can go back and forth as well. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
The situation with grandchildren.
Yeah.
If you have different expectations in your house than their parents have, can you say in my house this is not
okay? Good, good, very good question. Very good question. Yeah.
Another part connected to that. you have two children, they raise their children differently, you babysitting for both. How do you deal
okay.
with the difference?
Okay, very good questions. In terms of your house, it depends what it is. If you're saying in your house because you think that's the way children are supposed to be parented, no. If it's in your house because your house is not as childproof, and they can't throw a football around your living room because they're going to break things, whereas in your parents' living room is more oriented towards children, or you go to sleep earlier so they can't, you know, play the Nintendo till all hours because you know, that's a different story. In other words, it would be like anybody else they're visiting, they're accommodating you, but it's because you think that, you know, they should only be watching an hour TV a night, and the parents only watch 2 hours. If the parents only watch 2 hours, that's their children. You can maybe again carefully suggest a parent, maybe better, et cetera, but you can't say my house when it's purely for parent. But again, if it's accommodation because of the circumstances of your house or the circumstances of your age, that's like anybody else they're going to be visiting. And then you make that clear. It's because, Bobby and Zadie got to go to sleep earlier. You know, it's something along those lines. In terms of the second question was whether they have different ways of raising two children. You don't, again, they...
You've got both of them in your house.
Doesn't matter. They decide how their children are raised.
And then... As I said, how do you cope with it? We want the lad to be doing one thing in your house.
That's your deal with your mother. That's your mother's rule. When they complain, discuss it with your mother. It's not my rule. They're the general, you're the sergeant, you know? So you have authority, but your authority defers to them because they are the parents. So when they complain, how come it's not fair? I said, I don't know. Discuss it with your mother. I'm just implementing her. Oh, you don't use that word, but I'm just, you know, whatever. I'm just doing what she tells me to do. Okay. You had something right in your book.
Yeah, my problem is I have all daughters.
Uh-huh. That's a problem.
No, it isn't a problem. But in this sense, it is that no matter what their needs are, they feel very, very strongly that what I do for A, I have to do for B, I have to do for C, I have to do for D. And sometimes they have different needs.
You're right. You're right. You can't be, you can never be, you can't, I mean, my father, right.
It's not that I love you more, I love you less.
When I was a kid, my father used to say that he has to count the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola, because no matter what he poured, it was always, you can't be 100% fair. And
but how do you make them understand that I love them all the same? It's just.
By not getting caught up in that. By not getting caught up in that. You know something? God does the same thing. Look around you. Some people have more money, some people have more nacha, some people have more, you know, it's fair. We portion out what everybody needs. All right? So you give, to the best of your judgment, what everybody needs. Don't get caught up in that. Don't defend yourself. Because sometimes, you know, it's like how many times you beat your wife, you know. If you're starting to defend yourself, that means you do it, you know. You don't defend yourself. Look, I'm doing the best I can. Don't let, because that's something, that's a life lesson, because these same girls are going to go out in the world and see that somebody else is prettier than them, and somebody else is richer than them, and somebody else has husband's making more money, whatever, you know, there's inequities, and that's, we cope with that, you know. Yeah. Glad you mentioned that.
You know, and I have noticed what I've done personally. I always say to my kids, you know that we're always there for you. If you ever need anything financially, we will be there. But we believe you should grow on your own.
Yeah.
No,
you help. You don't give. In fact, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes there's a famous story about a king who gave his son a gold coin. And the kid really liked the gold coin. And one day he took him up to the mountain and said, throw the gold coin off a cliff. He threw him up the cliff. Then one day he said to the kid, you want another gold coin? He said, yeah. So cut the lawn and milk the cows and blah, 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 blah. Okay, I'm finished. Okay, we'll have to end with the story. He said, then he took him up on the cliff. He said, now throw the gold coin over. And he said, no. When you work for something, you appreciate it much more. So it's, even if you can afford, let's say they buy each one of your kids, sometimes to let them struggle a little bit with the mortgage and let them, they'll enjoy the house more that way. You know what I tell my kids? When my kids complain, let's say the cones, you know, does. I'll tell you what I say, okay? I'll tell you what I say when I'm with that. When I say the cones, let they give their kids more, I say, have to understand the difference between the Blumenthals and the cones. The cones love their children. It ends the conversation dead. It's like, it's finished, you know? It's like, okay, thank you very much.